Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
My next guest usually joins us to look back at events from the past 100 or even 200 years, but Professor of Modern Irish History Dermot Ferriter's latest book, The Revelation of Ireland, covers the years from 1995 to 2020. So how does a historian view the period that we've just lived through, and what are the challenges of writing such contemporary history? Dermot, you're very welcome to the studio, and congratulations on the new tome, which I have in my hands here. Is it hard for you to look back at such a recent period with the historian's gimlet eye?
Oh, it's a very different kind of challenge and a very different kind of history writing. It's essentially contemporary history, but through a long historical lens. So you're trying to make sense of events that are recent and that you've lived through yourself. You can't claim to be remote from it all. You can't claim complete academic detachment, but you do strive for a fairness. There's nothing new in this challenge. You know, I remember looking back at John A. Murphy, the Cork historian, wrote a history of the 20th century in 1975. And he talked about that in the introduction, about how difficult it was to try and remove yourself. And there's no point in pretending that you do, but that you do have to try and strive towards fairness. Mm-hmm. But it's also, I think, particularly in this day and age, about making the point about the way in which we absorb information about the now and try and understand the now. And there does tend to be, particularly as a result of social media, kind of a closing down of a long historical view. And Eric Hobsbawm would have made that point at the end of the 20th century. We can't have people growing up without a sense of the public past of the times that they live in. And we, you know, we live with the tyranny of the instant,
the treadmill of the
constant now. So it is about taking a step back, trying to put the events into context. I mean, look at what you've been talking about this morning.
Yes.
You've been talking about abuse, about redress. Yep. You've been talking about a sustainable economy. I mean, all of these issues are there. The question is, what kind of a framework of interpretation can you put on them? When I'm looking back now at 25 years, what seems transient, or what was of more lasting significance? And even, you know, Dermot Martin asked a question, a very plaintive question in 2018. What was it in Irish Catholicism that led to such a level of harshness?
I put it to him this morning because I read it in your book last night.
But I mean, if you want to answer that question, you're not going to find the answer 20 years ago. You have to start going back to the archives over 150 years and the way in which the church developed in the post-famine period.
Isn't it interesting that he said this morning, the question hasn't been answered. It was posed at a very senior level by the Pope, and no one knows the answer to it.
No, it hasn't been answered. And I mean, even with regard to what's been revealed in recent days, when you look at the Ryan Commission report in 2009, the point was made that it's not possible to establish the extent of the abuse in boys' schools. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to do justice to it. And part of this book, of course, is about allowing those stories to breathe and the personal testimony, and much of it is harrowing. But at the same time, not being drowned by outrage, because we do need to ask those questions and to keep asking them and keep looking for answers. And they can often emerge in different ways. I'm very interested in that emotional hinterland of experience. Those voices are very powerful voices. They've also been tackled, I suppose, by our novelists and our poets and even our musicians, trying to get in touch with kind of these ancestral pulses.
And I love that you've included all of that, actually, and how all of those things have impacted right across the board, including the cultural points that you've just mentioned there. Listen, can we go back then to Dear Daughter? That was a documentary aired in RTE in 1996. Was that the moment, the beginning of this sea of grief, you know, the revelations that started from that, which led us to where we are now?
Isn't that description, the sea of grief, very interesting? Nuala Fualan wrote very powerfully about this at the time. And she said that Ireland was floating on a sea of grief because of what was emerging. That was in 1996. Yeah. Now, when you look at it through the longer lens, of course, that sea, that was just a ripple compared to what was coming. And Enda Macdonagh, the moral theologian, in 1995, the year this book starts, he said in relation to the revelations that were coming out, that we were living through a period of winter darkness, of the darkness of death because of these revelations. He was talking about the atmosphere. But look at everything that came tumbling out. They kept tumbling out and they still come tumbling out. But that was a very important moment, and Christine Buckley became a very powerful advocate in relation to what had happened in Goldenbridge. But it also raised interesting questions about the role of the state, about the role of religious orders, about the power alliances that had been built up, about the fault lines that existed, about class, about snobbery, about contempt, because an awful lot of these people had one thing in common: they were from impoverished backgrounds. So again, it was trying to make sense of how that was allowed to happen, that reliance on institutions, but broadcasting it, broadcasting the voices of the victims, of the inmates, of those who had lived through it, trying to see it through their lens. That's a very important role for the historian, to respect that, but then also to try and appreciate the wider currents around it that had built up over many decades.
So that was 1996, but I'm just going to go back again now to where this book starts in 1995. You know, it's called The Revelation of Ireland, and really you could argue that the divorce referendum in that year was the real start of this, the start of proper change, social and cultural change. I have a clip here. The 1995 referendum on divorce was incredibly close, and this reminds us just how close it was.
Polling day saw heavy rain in the west and bright sunshine in Dublin, where there was a higher turnout. As the votes were counted, Una Bandic Fahuna of the No Divorce campaign made her displeasure clear.
Will he now give a guarantee to the women whom we met at the doors that they will not in fact be slapped out on the road and that their houses and homes will not be sold?
All right, Una, let me hear me.
It sounds as if we're going to win. She sounds very upset.
But as the results poured in that Saturday afternoon, it became clear that the winning margin would be unimaginably tight.
It's on a knife edge. The no's are ahead by a whisker at the moment, with only two results still to come in. Here's the ODS.
The results from the constituency of Dublin North East. Total votes in favour, 25,360. Total votes against, 13,718.
The new history is that Ireland has voted for divorce. It's perhaps a case of hello divorce, goodbye devil era.
Now, there you go. So the No campaign said, of course, hello divorce, goodbye
that
daddy.
Was a play
that was
one
of, that. One of their
slogans.
Yeah. And
one of,
and
one of their earlier slogans in 1986 had been God says no and taxpayer pays 200 million per annum. And there was a lot of focus in 1986 on property and money. Mm-hmm. I think what changed by 1995, and of course there was no clear path to victory for those who were advocating a yes, that's how tight it became. But there's much more of a focus on the lived reality as opposed to the ideal. You know, this ideal of stable family units and happy marriages. It was widely cited that there were 80,000 people living with marriage breakdown in Ireland in 1995. And that was actually an underestimation, because we know from the census the following year there were actually 95,000 and there were 23,000 deserted wives. And that narrative started to breathe a bit more. But there were also those who were deeply disturbed at the idea of this shift. And you start to see patterns emerging in terms of differences between rural and urban Ireland and different parts of the country. There's also a generational question about how people are viewing marriage. But even, you know, the idea of the family itself was changing, or what constituted the Irish family. I mean, by the end of the 1990s, 30% of births were to unmarried mothers. And even if you look at the question of marriage, you know, 96% of marriages in the early 1970s were Catholic ceremonies. It reduced to just over 40% in recent years. So you can begin to see these templates that are shifting, but also people trying to make sense of it. And you have to respect that as well. You can't just craft a narrative of progress. You know, there are people who are struggling to come to terms with the shifting certainties. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're clinging to a crumbling narrative, not just in relation to social and so-called moral or religious questions, but also generally in relation to politics and political culture.
Yeah,
and
you can I really see want to talk to you about that, because it's just so interesting. And look, it's great to read a history book and which you've lived through. You know, you can remember the events firsthand. But you talk about political ideology. You talk about how Bertie Ahern did politics compared to how Fine Gael did politics. The Just Society, how Enda Kenny carried that forward, but in a slightly different way. Has that changed much from 1995, from the late 90s to where we are now? Or do you still see it reflected in politics that we have today?
You do still see it reflected. There's quite a rhetorical mishmash, you know, when it comes to what people are supposed to stand for. But there's generally a hostility to the idea of ideology or ideological positioning. Some people might have expected in 2011 with the great collapse of Fianna Fáil, and it's quite an earthquake in that sense, given the historic dominance, that a new politics would have emerged. Now, it was a more fractured politics. It was new in that sense, but mm-hmm. not in ideological terms. We did generally stick with the same model, and it really is about the drive towards the centre. And political scientists were making predictions in 2011 that things might begin to change. There'd be more of a focus on reform, but also the way we do politics. And I remember reading a piece by the Irish Times journalist Roisin Ingle, and she described being woken up on a Saturday morning by a knock on the door from the Taoiseach, Bertie Ahern, who was out canvassing. And she said, what other European country would the Prime Minister make unsolicited house calls at the weekend? And years later, I was actually interviewing Bertie Ahern in 2016 for a BBC documentary on 100 years of Anglo-Irish relations to coincide with the commemoration of the 1916 Rising. And we went to interview Bertie Ahern. He was out of office at that stage in a fairly run-down office in Drumcondra. This is after he had moved from St. Luke's. And the BBC journalist was astonished that we could just go and knock on the door and make this arrangement. And he described trying to get an interview with Tony Blair, Ahern's great ally, and the ring of steel that was around him. But it was also, I suppose, about accessibility. A lot of people liked that, you know, that sense of contact and accessibility. But there was also a focus on, well, is that what politicians should be doing ultimately? But Bertie Ahern was able to combine those different elements quite cleverly, because I'm also seeing him now through the archive, particularly the archive of the peace process. And that was about leadership. And that was, of course, about the combination of civil servants and politicians, you know, trying to make a breakthrough. So you get those elements as well. But generally speaking, a lot of our political ideas and a lot of our political models didn't really alter that significantly.
And how much weight do you give to the peace process and the Good Friday Agreement in the revelation of Ireland, that moment in 1998?
Oh, massive. You know, the revelation that it was possible to come to some sort of accommodation that would bring the killing to an end, over 3,600 people having been killed. It wasn't, of course, a perfect peace. It's still not a perfect peace. And I also deal, I suppose, with a younger generation's perspective, that the so-called ceasefire babies, they felt they had been loaded with an awful lot of the trauma of that period. But it's fascinating to be in the room. You know, when you're in the archives now in Belfast and London and Dublin, because the peace process papers, a lot of them are available, and you're getting very detailed accounts of the conversations, the transcript of phone calls between Ahern and Blair, the actual disgruntlement that existed at the idea of having to communicate with the parties, you know, themselves, talking to their enemies, histrionics, there's creativity, there's ambiguity, there are tantrums. And George Mitchell, he was described by a friend as having trained himself not to luxuriate in drama. And that was quite a feat in a process that was surrounded by drama, but also a very male process. And Monica McWilliams of the Women's Coalition, you know, described David Trimble at one stage sticking his head in the door and saying, where are the buns, ladies? You know, that deeply ingrained sexism in Northern Ireland and more generally, the idea that the honest Ulster woman should not be involved in politics. So you have all of that as well. I mean, Monica suggested that it would be a greater challenge to break down the patriarchy than it would the sectarian tensions in Northern Ireland. But they did take risks. And, you know, at one stage, Bertie Ahern describes in a private memorandum having a 2.5 hour meeting with the bearded one, and there was blood on the walls. And of course, he was talking about Gerry Adams, because there are all these rows about decommissioning and everything else. David Trimble becomes a fascinating character because he's leading a divided party, but he takes the jump.
Yeah.
And he told his friend Herb Wallace, I have changed, you know, but he had the Paisley Wolf at his door.
So you, having gone through all of those archives and sat down and read them all, you get a sense of just how difficult it was to get to that point. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and it's partly, you know, one of the senior civil servants described, like, there's an awful lot of tedious drafting and redrafting of memoranda, you know, but he described trying to move from metaphorical language to hard, sharp points. When can you spot the subtle shifts? When are people prepared to shift significantly? And a lot of those who are prepared to settle for much less than their traditional political ideals or ambitions, they can present things or spin things in a particular way. At one stage, Mark Durkin of the SDLP says, we are a party more spinned against than spinning. You know, there was a recognition, as he put it, that they would see the agreement in 1998 as a hologram in which everyone could claim their version or their victory. But of course, there was compromise on different sides. That was very difficult for people to stomach, you know. Yeah. I mean, Arlene Foster, of course, walked out at that stage, as did Geoffrey Donaldson. But they remain players within unionism.
You touched on the economic crash, and there's a moment that you focus on in the book in 2011 with Brian Lenehan preparing to fly from Dublin to Brussels in November of 2010. And that flight was him going to accept the bailout.
He felt humiliated. He felt sad. The way he put it was that he had fought the good fight. Now, you can argue about that, but that hell was now at the gates, this national humiliation. And I think he was also carrying a particular historical perspective because his father, Brian Lennon, of course, had been such a senior figure in Fianna Fáil. His grandfather before that, the War of Independence era. And he was carrying that feeling at that time. And it was also, of course, about Ireland recognising on one level how peripheral it was and how vulnerable and fragile it was. But at the same time, the ECB and Europe, those who were centralised, had centralised power in Europe, were determined that the euro would not fail and that Ireland had to find a particular course, and they felt that they were bounced into this. And of course, the ECB's own failings with regard to the great lending that had gone on, they were conveniently forgotten. But it was just that moment. He described looking out on the snow, at the snow, and feeling humiliated. And there was a sense of national humiliation.
It was.
But in a sense, Claire, there was also a degree of relief when the Troika arrived and laid out the full scale of the difficulty, because we weren't getting that information. It wasn't being communicated to us by our political leaders. And there were denials and there were delusions. And then the scale of it was unveiled. But what would that involve ultimately? It really was about private debts becoming public liabilities and responsibilities. And that had devastating consequences. We had about 3,000 ghost estates a couple of years later, which were very powerful symbols of so much that had gone wrong.
Listen, I don't want to leave people with the impression that this is all about politics, because it is far from that. You explore the changing nature within Irish culture, the status of women evolving, the emergence of a generation born in Ireland on a scale that we haven't seen before, with parents who arrived here from all over the world, and how that has impacted the Ireland of today.
Well, by 2011, 17% of the people in Ireland were born outside of Ireland. That was much higher than the European average. And there were people here from 199 countries. Who would have thought that 36% of the population of Gort would be Brazilians, or that there would be nearly 50,000 Muslims in Ireland? What's fascinating about it is that it represents the great historical reversal. We as a people historically had left Ireland. We had gone out. The population in 1996 in the Republic was just 3.6 million. It went to over 5 million. But how does that process of integration work? There are success stories, but there are also great difficulties. I mean, the texture of Irish society changes dramatically. And there were those debating the status of refugees in 1995. John O'Donoghue of Fianna Fáil said, for example, in the Dáil, that every man, woman and child in this country who has any grasp of Irish history should understand the plight of the refugee. But, you know, words are one thing. You have to also look at the question of how society is going to deal with this massive change. And again, inevitably tensions are going to emerge. But it's also about the politics of belonging. And that's not an Irish story. That's a much wider European theme throughout this period.
Is this in the shops today?
It is,
today?
Yes.
The Revelation of Ireland, 1995 to 2020 by Diarmaid Farrater. Now, you're going to be speaking at the Dublin Festival of History on the 29th of September. And people can book that on dublinfestivalofhistory.ie. You'll also be in the Drumminear Nina Literary Festival on the 10th of October. And if people want to go to that, dnlf.ie. Diarmaid, thank you so much. It's a great read, a really fascinating look back, but not too far.
Thank you very much, Claire.
Thanks so much. That's Diarmaid Farrater.